Good afternoon, brothers and sisters. As you can imagine, the last 2,000 years has quite a bit of history. And I know history may not be the most exciting topic for some people. So to keep our interest, we're going to do something just a little different today, a little unconventional. I hope it's okay with everyone. They're handing out little devices that we can answer questions with. And you'll see on that device that there's different numbers, 1 through 4. And as we pose a question, we'll have 10 seconds for everybody to answer it, and we'll see how good we are. So actually, we'll start out with the first one. Which is correct? 1, head of gold is Babylon. 2, chest of silver is the Medo-Persians. 3, legs of brass is Rome. And 4, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, was king of Babylon. So if you'll answer that. And looks like 33 of us said Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. 43, head of gold is Babylon. The correct answer is leg of brass is Rome, is actually iron, not brass. And the next one. Who was the emperor during the time of Christ? 1, Herod. 2, Tiberius. 3, Nero. 4, Titus. Looks like most of us said Herod, 64%. Answer is actually Tiberius. So our topic this weekend is God's 7,000-year plan. So far we've looked at the first 4,000 years from creation. Now we will focus on the events occurring during the last 2,000 years, roughly from 4,000 to 6,000 years from creation, and then ending with the return of Christ. We will start out by discussing Christ and how he fit into God's plan. Then we will focus on a brief review of some of the events of the world since Christ up to the current time, focusing primarily on those related to God's plan as revealed to us in Revelations. Regarding Christ, we will look at 2 points. First, how did Christ relate to God's plan? And second, why did he appear when he did? Or was his appearance just a random act? First of all, it's fairly easy to see that God had in his plan that a Messiah would come. We can see that he would be descendant of Adam and Eve and destroy Satan, that he would be descendant of Abram, Isaac, and Jacob. No bones would be broken. He'd be prophet like unto Moses. He'd be king of Zion, son of God. His body would not be left in the grave or see corruption. He'd be betrayed by a friend. He'd be offered gall and vinegar to drink. He'd be rejected and hated for his work. That he would sit at the right hand of God after the order of Melchizedek, being a priest. He'd be born of a virgin, that he'd have a ministry that begins in Galilee, that he'd be chief cornerstone of the kingdom. He would perform miracles. He'd be preceded by a messenger. He'd be spat on and beaten. He'd be condemned as a sinner. He'd be descendant of David. He'd be called out of Egypt. He'd be born at Bethlehem. He would enter Jerusalem riding on a donkey. He'd be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. And that he'd be pierced. So the Old Testament writings were clear that a Messiah was coming. And in fact, there is a direct allusion to Christ in all the prophetic writings, with the exception of maybe Jonah. The observing Jews knew that the Messiah would come and were looking for him. John sent his disciples to Jesus and said, "Art thou he that cometh, or look we for another?" And Philip, finding Nathanael, saith unto him, "We have found him whom Moses in the law and the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." So they knew that the Messiah was in God's plan, but they had to be convinced that this Jesus was the Messiah. Now the question is, why did God come when he did? Well, Galatians 4 says, "But when the fullness of time came, God sent forth his Son, born of woman, born under the law." Now, there's a lot to this verse that might not be evident upon first glance. So let's take each section at a time. The fullness of time. What did that mean? First, it was the appointed time set by God. And we'll look at this a little bit further as we proceed. But also, 2, as I think our brother Jim Somerville said in the BN a few years ago, there was a tremendous corruption in Israel with a position of high priest up for sale for the highest bidder. And it was eventually given to one of the tribe of Benjamin. So God did send his Son at appointed time. This wasn't by accident. It wasn't random. Next, Christ was born of a woman. Christ was born of a woman, the seed of Eve, which brings us back to Genesis in the first reference to the coming Messiah and gives us a clue to his mission and what he was to accomplish. That figuratively, Christ would bruise the serpent's head and that serpent would bruise Christ's heel. And then the last phrase, born under the law. Christ had to be made while the law was still in effect to be under it and in order to eventually fulfill it. Therefore, he had to live while the Mosaic law was still in effect. If he had been born in AD 70 when the temple was destroyed, he may not have been able to fulfill the law completely. Matthew 5 says, "Think not that I come to destroy the law or the prophets. I came not to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot and one tittle shall in no wise pass away from the law till all things be accomplished." He had to be born under the law with our sinful nature. He had to live a life completely within the guidelines of the law. And he had to die while still under the rule of the Mosaic law. Romans 7 says, "The law hath dominion over man so long as he liveth." So that when he died, the law had no further jurisdiction over him. And since he didn't break any commandments, fulfilling all the requirements, the grave and death could not hold him, for the result of sin is death, yet he had no sin. Therefore, the risen Christ was a free man, so to speak, free of the law, and therefore breaking the chains of sinful nature. Now back to the question, why did Christ come when he did? Well, let's look at a rough timeline. Our brother Seth kind of went over some of this morning. We recall that almost every Old Testament book had reference to the coming Messiah. Well, in Daniel, it's much more specific as to the timing. Just to orient ourselves to the graph, we have the image of Daniel 2 showing the head of gold corresponding to the era of the Babylonians that ruled the land, including the notable king of Nebuchadnezzar. It was during his reign at 592 BC that the temple was burned. The next portion of the image was a chest of silver corresponding to the Medo-Persian Empire, starting with Darius the Mede and Cyrus, and who recall diverted the river running through Babylon, allowing his army to overtake the city. After Cyrus, we have Darius the Persian, and later on, Artaxerxes. Next, we have the belly of brass, which represents the Greeks. And lastly, we have the legs of iron representing Rome, which was, of course, the ruling power during Christ's time. As we were saying, Daniel had a specific time period that revealed when the Messiah, the Anointed One, would come. Daniel 9:24 says, 70 weeks are decreed upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation for iniquity and to bring an everlasting righteousness and to seal up vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. The next verse tells us the start date, from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem. So when did that happen? Well, Nehemiah says, "And it came to pass in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king, that he sent a letter unto Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the castle and for the walls of the city." So 70 weeks is 490 days, taking Ezekiel's example of each day for a year. That puts us at 490 years. If the decree went out at 456 B.C., the 20th Artaxerxes, that would put us at A.D. 33, the year of the crucifixion. So it wasn't a random time in history that Christ came on the scene. It was in the script. It was written beforehand and planned from the beginning. Now, if you'll take your deals again, we'll answer two more questions. These may be a little bit tougher. Who was the general that overtook Jerusalem in AD 70? First one is Vespasian. Second one is Titus. Third one is Napoleon. Fourth one, Julius Caesar. Looks like most of us said Titus, which is correct. Next question. The Emperor Augustus was the first emperor of Rome, was the last emperor of Rome, changed his name from Octavius, or for all the above? Looks like most of us answered all the above, which is correct. The first emperor was Octavius Augustus, and the last emperor of Rome in the western side was Romulus Augustus. Now we'll switch gears just a little bit, and we'll look at the history of the region from just before Christ being born all the way to the return of Christ. We all recall that the governing nation during Christ's time was Rome. 50 years before Christ, one of Rome's most famous leaders, Julius Caesar, ruled. His death led to civil war between Mark Antony, and who was allied with Cleopatra, against Octavius. When Mark Antony heard falsely that Cleopatra had died, he committed suicide. And when Cleopatra heard this, it prompted her to do the same thing, leaving Octavius to be sole ruler of the Republic in B.C. 30. He changed his name to Caesar Augustus, and he is mentioned in Luke 2:1. Now it came to pass in those days there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be enrolled. When he died in the Republic was expanding and was becoming an empire, with Caesar Augustus becoming the first emperor. The 12th chapter of Revelation identifies each of the first 12 emperors up to the time when John received the revelation with a star composing a wreath. Therefore, Augustus was this first emperor, the first star on the wreath, the last of which would be Nerva right at the time of John the Baptist. Next in line was Tiberius, who reigned during the time of Christ. He is mentioned in Luke 3:1. Now, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, and Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip, tetrarch of the region, etc., when he died in AD 37, he left the empire to his nephew, Caligula. Now, Caligula started out his reign with generosity and goodwill, releasing prisoners and giving amnesty. Then he came down with an illness that historians feel was probably epilepsy. After recovering from one episode, he was a different man, with mania, causing delusions of grandeur and divinity. He would kill people just to humor himself, and sometimes his own supporters for no apparent reason. He was even known to invite his favorite horse to dine alongside him and his guests. Next in line was Claudius, who is mentioned in Acts 18:2. And he found a certain Jew named Aquila, a man of Pontus by race, lately come from Italy, with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to depart from Rome. He married and adopted his wife's son, Nero, who later succeeded him. Nero was highly educated, but also became deranged during his reign. He had his mother killed. In AD 64, half of Rome burned down. He accused the Christians of causing the fire, and in response, started brutally persecuting the Christians, including burning Christians alive in public display. Paul and Peter were killed during his reign, along with thousands of Christians. During his reign in AD 67, a Jewish revolt broke out. Nero dispatched Vespasian to Israel to take care of the revolt. Vespasian fought several battles in Israel and was headed to Jerusalem when he learned of Nero's death in AD 69. This ended up leaving Vespasian as emperor, who left his son Titus to fight against Jerusalem, which he destroyed in AD 70. Before the siege of Jerusalem, there was a terrible amount of infighting in the city. One group, called the Temple Party, because they took refuge in and held up in the temple, was headed by a man named John. They incited terror throughout the city, killing and stealing at will. Anyone trying to leave the city was killed, and general massacre ensued within the city. Anyone caught burying the dead was killed, saying that they were supporting the deserters, so that large numbers of dead bodies began to accumulate. All this even before the Romans showed up. Then General Titus encircled the city and began the siege of Jerusalem in April AD 70. He posted his 10th legion on the Mount of Olives. After a 143-day siege, which began at Passover. 30,000 Roman troops overtook Jerusalem. The inhabitants, as well as a great number of visitors for Passover who had been trapped there, were brutally slaughtered, with an estimated 1 million people killed. Titus took the treasures of Jerusalem and the temple back to Rome. Titus had actually intended to spare the temple, giving orders to not burn it, but this was not God's plan, and some of the soldiers burned it anyway. On the 10th of August, AD 70, the temple was burned, which is said to be the very day it was first burned by King of Babylon in BC 586. The Roman army then moved over to the city of Caesarea, named after Caesar, on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, where a great many more Jews were killed. By AD 70, Jerusalem and Judea were left desolate. Most of the people either killed or enslaved or had fled as refugees to other lands. All that remained in Israel was the defiant little garrison atop a hill called Masada, a fortress near the Dead Sea, which was built by Herod the Great. After Vespasian died, Titus became emperor. The next ruler of Rome was Domitian, who ruled until AD 96, at which time Nerva assumed the rule. AD 96 was an important date in history, as it is when John was on the Isle of Patmos. Patmos is a small island about 13 miles square, population of about 3,000 currently. It's here that John was given the revelations of Christ. These revelations show a prophetic plan of unfolding history. Within this was a series of prophecies that spelled out some of the major events that would happen. Now we have our next question. All of these cities are the same except 1, Constantinople, 2, Istanbul, 3, Athens, 4, Byzantium. Very good, Athens. Second question. Pick the correct order. This is a little trickier. Trumpets, seals, thunders, vials. Seals, trumpets, vials, thunders. Thunders, vials, seal, trumpets. Seals, vials, thunder, trumpets. Repeat that. Very good. As we were saying, these revelations show a prophetic plan of unfolding history. Within this was a series of prophecies that spelled out some of the major events that would happen. Part of that prophecy includes a series of 7 seals, 7 trumpets, and 7 vials. 7 is a number for completion or perfection, which will happen at the end of the 7,000 years that we're studying this weekend. The first 6 seals were intended to show us the history of pagan Rome until it was removed by Constantine, revealing the apostasy of the Roman Empire. The 7th and last seal revealed the trumpets. The first 6 trumpets describe the judgments of Christian Rome. The 7th and last trumpet then sounded, revealing the 7 vials. The first 6 vials tell us of the judgments of the Holy Roman Empire in the west, as well as the drying up of the Turkish Empire in the east, which prepares the way for the entry of Christ. The 7th vial has 7 thunders indicating judgments on Catholic Rome, or Catholic Europe, by Christ and the saints. After the thunders, the millennium begins with a new heaven and a new earth. Also, between each of these series of 7s, there's described an earthquake, with Constantine indicated by the first one, next to the French Revolution, and ultimately Christ will usher in the last one with Armageddon. Now we'll look at each of these a little closer. Revelation 6 introduces us to the events related to these 7 sealed scrolls. As the first 4 seals are opened, a horse is revealed. The horse was a symbol of pagan Rome. Each horse had a different color, indicating different conditions that would occur during that era. The first seal brought the white horse, which represented peace. It lasted from AD 96 with the death of Domitian, to 183. It was a time of peace for the Roman Empire. This time period included the reigns of 6 Roman emperors, which you see at the bottom of the chart. Nerva, who was the emperor during John's exile to Patmos. Trajan, under whom the Roman Empire reached its greatest territorial extent. Hadrian, who built the Temple of Jupiter on the site of Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem, and ended with the start of Commodus. The second seal revealed the red horse and lasted until AD 211. 10 different Caesars lost their lives to assassinations during this time period that changed this white horse of peace over to a red horse of bloodshed. The Praetorian Guard was a group of soldiers commissioned to protect Rome, but during this period they rose in power and started to tyrannize the population. The third seal brings the black horse of mourning and lasted from 212 to 235. The rider holds a balance, indicating the severe taxation that the Roman emperors inflicted on the people to support the army. This led to poverty and famine. The last emperor in this period, Severus, reduced the taxation to 1/30 of what had been previously. However, it was too late, as the effect had already devastated Rome. It did relieve the suffering of the people slightly, though, corresponding to the "See thou hurt not the oil and the wine." Severus was murdered shortly thereafter. The fourth seal revealed the pale green horse, indicating death and the grave. Famine affected a fourth of the Roman Empire, and half the population died from it. 39 emperors were assassinated during this time period. With the fifth seal, we see a change. There isn't a horse. This time period marks a tremendous persecution under Diocletian, with sounds of the faithful crying from beneath the altar. Diocletian recognized that the empire was too large for one person to rule, and so he split it into two, maintaining control over the eastern half, here indicated in the brown, with the western half in the green. But this didn't last long, as Constantine would later temporarily reunite the two under his leadership. The sixth seal brings a dramatic change, a great earthquake, a political earthquake, indicating Constantine's overthrow of paganism and replacing it with Christianity, which becomes the national religion. He built the new capital of Constantinople and moved the seat of government there. The unification of the eastern and western legs of the empire didn't last long, and after Constantine's death, it split again, the western leg only lasting another 150 years. You can see the extent of the Roman Empire here indicated in red. Constantine's appearance was actually prophesied in another portion of Revelations. Chapter 12 says, "And a great sign was seen in heaven, a woman arrayed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars, and she was with child, and she cried out, travailing in birth and in pain to be delivered." Now, the gestation of a woman is 9 months, but more specifically, 280 days. So taking a day for a year, it's 280 years. The true ecclesia was to be a chaste virgin, as we're told here in 2 Corinthians, wholly committed to Christ. Soon after the death of Christ, error crept in, and Christianity, instead of being a virgin, became pregnant with a seed of error. Now, if we put this into the graph of our timeline, we see that shortly after Christ's death, error started creeping in. And 280 years later, which puts us at the time of Constantine, the papacy was officially born and became the state religion of Rome. When the seventh seal is opened in the eighth chapter of Revelations, it says there was a silence in heaven for a half an hour, which represents approximately 15 years of peace. This lasted until the death of Constantine, which was then followed by several years of revolts and wars and internal fighting. The seal also revealed seven angels holding seven trumpets. The trumpet was to be used to assemble people, and here it signifies the assembling of groups of people against the Roman Empire. The first four affect the Western Roman Empire, and the last two, the Eastern. The first trumpet was sounded in AD 395. It brought the Goths from around the area of Sweden. The Goths had migrated to within the boundaries of the Roman Empire, trying to get protection from their neighbors, the Huns, that were attacking them. During this time, the Gothic people were incorporated into the Roman army. One of their members, Alaric, became a Roman general. But during his time in the Roman army, he would note that the Romans would always send the Gothic people to the hottest portion of the battle. The Gothic people also struggled with poverty and starvation and were not helped by the Romans, which led Alaric to revolt and liberate the Gothic people. He then overthrew Italy, 1/3 of the empire, and took Rome. Alaric died in 410 BC, and the Goths dispersed. Concerning the Goths, there were two tribes, the Visigoths in the west and the Ostrogoths in the east. The second trumpet was blown against the islands and coastal lands of the Mediterranean, Spain, and Italy. It brought Genseric, the Vandal, who ferried all 80,000 of his people across to Africa in 429 and set up his base in Carthage. His people became pirates along the coastal lines, destroying the Roman fleet. The western third of the Roman Empire was ravaged, and hence we now have the word vandalism. After negotiating with the city of Rome and agreeing not to destroy it, the gates of Rome were opened, letting Genseric in, who died in 477 AD. The third trumpet period sounded, and a great star fell upon the third part. This brought in Attila the Hun, who fell in the area north of Italy. Attila brought terror throughout the empire, which was heightened by the Huns' ferociousness and wild appearance. His campaign was cut short when he lost half of his men at a battle of Chalons, and he returned to his homeland after 3 years. You can see the area that he ruled in the green. The fourth trumpet brought Odoacer, king of the Goths. Odoacer overthrew Rome's last emperor, Romulus Augustus, and claimed himself king, causing the sun and moon and stars of the western third of the empire to cease to shine. This ended the Western Roman Empire and brought the seventh head of the Roman beast to power, which reigned for 60 years. Now this makes sense when we consider Revelation 13. I saw one of the heads as it were wounded to death, referring to that sixth head, the imperial head, which was wounded by the Goths. Now after Odoacer died, then Theodoric the Great followed him. At the end of 60 years of Gothic reign, the Goths were defeated and that imperial system was restored to Rome, and thus the deadly wound was healed. Now returning our thoughts back to the Emperor Constantine, who established Christianity as a national religion. In AD 330, he recognized the strength of Byzantium in the east and renamed it Constantinople, present-day Istanbul. This established the two legs of Daniel's image, with the western leg being centered in Rome and the eastern leg centered in Constantinople. The fifth and sixth trumpets are directed against this eastern leg of the image. The fifth trumpet is also the first woe and is identified with Mohammed and the Mohammedan forces, otherwise known as the Saracen power. Mohammed came from the Arabia as locust and invaded Israel and the Eastern Roman Empire, but he never took Constantinople. Thus, the Eastern Empire, although greatly reduced in size, still retained its political headquarters. The Saracens had long flowing hair and beards, in contrast to the Romans who were clean-shaven. They were seen wearing crowns of gold, nicely matching with their turbans. Their power was to last two periods of 5 months each, for a total of 10 months. Now, given 30 days in a month, this equals 300 days, and using our example from Ezekiel of a day for a year, gives us 300 years, from AD 632 to 932, which is the date the caliph lost his political power. Now the sixth woe trumpet started in AD 1062, bringing four Turkish powers against Constantinople. These are described as four angels released from the Euphrates area. These four were the Seljukians, the Mughals, the Tartars, and the Ottomans. Revelations 9:4 says, saying to the sixth angel which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year, for to slay the third part of men. Now that for an hour, a day, a month, and a year is 391 years, 1 month. This trumpet started in April 1062 when Togul Beg married the caliph's daughter and started waging war on the Eastern Roman Empire. Exactly 391 years and a month later, the city of Constantinople fell to the attacks of Muhammad II. With this came the end of the Roman Empire. The city became Islam in religion, and the Greek Catholicism was removed from the city, moving itself to Moscow, the Third Rome. The seventh trumpet period, discussed in chapter 11 of Revelations, is divided into seven vials, which is discussed in chapter 16 of Revelations. Now these vials are described as being filled with God's wrath, one by one being poured out upon the earth, until the final ones bring Christ and the Armageddon. The first five vials are poured out on Western Europe and the Holy Roman Empire, and pertain primarily to the effects of the French Revolution on the Holy Roman Empire, which is also described as an earthquake. The sixth vial is poured upon the Turkish Empire. So let's look at this first vial first, which was poured on the earth, bringing a grievous sore upon men which had the mark of the beast. France started having internal revolting, suffering from debt after having supported the Americans during the Revolution, and suffering because of high taxation and droughts. This led to revolts from the commoners. The Catholic Church at the time owned 10% of the land in France, and this wasn't being taxed, which caused frustration with the people. This eventually caused a rift between France and the Church. The second vial was poured out on the sea, and it became like the blood of a dead man. Britain exerted her control over the Catholic maritime powers. The British destroyed over 1,000 of their ships during this period. They completely demolished any ability to go by sea. The third vial was poured out on the rivers and fountains of waters. Now, it brought Napoleon in 1796 against Italy, and ended up deposing the Pope in 1798. Napoleon was elevated from general to ruler. Fourth vial was poured upon the sun, and the remnants of the Holy Roman Empire was completely removed. Napoleon was proclaimed Emperor of France in 1804. The following year, Austria, Russia, and England declare war. Austria and Russia were defeated in several battles as men were scorched by the great heat. In 1806, it brought an end to the Holy Roman Empire. The fifth vial poured out on the seat or throne of the beast. Napoleon took Pope Pius VI and imprisoned him in France, where he died. Napoleon was finally defeated at the Battle of Waterloo, and with his defeat, the Pope was restored to Rome by the powers of England, Russia, Prussia, and Sweden. Now, this is probably a good time to mention the prophecy of the evening morning period. Daniel 8:13 says, "Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, How long shall the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgressions of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, Unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed." Now, it should be noted here that other translations, instead of having 2,300 years, have 2,400 years. Now, if you add 2,400 years to the third year of King Belshazzar, which is 534, you get the year 1866. Now, why is that important? Well, it's the year that the Pope lost his temporal power. Temporal power means the political and governmental power as compared to the spiritual power. You can see some examples of this on the slide. It is well recognized that the Pope was involved in temporal activities throughout the ages. However, in 1866, after the Austro-Prussian War, the Pope's temporal power was removed. Jesus tells us in Revelation 11 that there would be a treading down of the Ecclesia by the Roman Catholic Church for 1,260 years. This period started when Emperor Justinian declared the Bishop of Rome to be chief bishop. Emperor Phocas reinforced this decree in 608. Adding 1,260 to these years shows us that the suppression of the truth would last until 1789, the French Revolution, and final removal of the state power of the papacy, which occurred in 1869 to 1870. Now, the sixth vial was poured out on the Turkish Empire, and the 19th century saw the drying up of this power. Just as Cyrus diverted the river that ran through the city of Babylonian and thereby dried up the riverbed, allowing his armies to overtake the Babylonians, this sixth vial shows a drying up of the powers of the Euphrates, or Turkish powers, which prepares the way for the return of Christ. So this sixth vial will include the return of Christ, who then will raise the dead and judge the responsible. Currently, we are in this sixth vial period, waiting for Christ's return. Generations still alive has seen incredible prophecies relating to this vial come to pass. There was another allusion to this time period in Leviticus, when God gave a warning to the Israelites of what would happen to them if they didn't obey. Leviticus 26:18 says, "And if you will not yet for these things hearken unto me, then I will chastise you seven times for your sins. Now, time is 360 years. Seven times would be 25, 20 years. The chastisement started with Babylon overtaking them in 604 BC. Adding 2,520 years to that gives us 1917. During World War I in 1917, General Alamein drove the Turks from the land of Israel, and the Balfour Declaration opened the doors to the Jews returning to the land. This reminds us of Christ's words in Luke of a sprout shooting forth, showing early signs of the Jewish nation reviving. Behold the fig tree and all the trees, and they now shoot forth. But when they now shoot forth, ye see it, and know of your own selves that summer is now nigh. Even so ye also, when ye see these things come to pass, know ye that the kingdom of God is nigh. Then in 1948, Hitler killed 6 million Jews in World War II, and the state of Israel was proclaimed. In 1967, Israel fights a six-day war, expanding its territory. In the very near future, Christ will return. He'll raise the dead and judge the responsible. Then Christ and the immortalized saints will begin their march to the rainbowed angel, leading to the battles of Armageddon. And this will conclude the sixth vial. And it leads us to the final vial, the seventh vial. It is poured out into the air of the world, bringing the period of seven thunders, all pointing forward to the time when Christ and the saints destroy that great harlot who committed fornication with the pure truth, mixing error with truth and calling it Christianity. After the last of the thunders ends, then the thousand-year reign of Christ and the millennial begins. It's obvious then that if the 7,000-year plan of God is really true, and we know it is, that we must be getting close to the end of time. In fact, you may be saying, if Christ is to come and establish his kingdom at the end of 6,000 years, then why, given that it's currently year 2011, almost 2012, why hasn't he come? Have we already passed year 6,000 since creation? Well, let's look at it a little closer. We recall that each day of creation represents 1,000-year time period, with 6 days of creation and one day of rest. Christ came around AD 0, and the commonly viewed idea is that year 0 was 4,000 years after creation. However, that might not be exactly correct. It's very possible that from creation to Christ's birth may have been closer to 3,900 years, 100 years earlier than commonly viewed. And wouldn't that make sense? And that this would put Christ's birth and death actually in day 4 rather than day 5. We recall from Genesis that day 4, the creation, the Son was manifested. And we recall that Christ is referred to the Son of Righteousness. So wouldn't it make sense that Christ would be manifested in this fourth day period? So if this is true, adding 3,900 to 2012, we see that there could be quite a few years to the end of the 6,000-year period. Now, does that mean that we have 80-some-odd years before Christ returns? No, because remember, we are in the fourth vial. There's still another vial to be poured out before the end of the 6,000 years and before the millennial reign begins. You see, at the bottom of the timeline, we are somewhere near the blue arrow. We know from Micah that this vial will take at least 40 great and terrible years. But there could also be several other years for the resurrection, judgment, marriage of the Lamb with the saints. So you see that although we're still within the 6,000-year time frame, we have to be getting close to the return of Christ. There's not much time left on the time frame. All the prophecies leading to Christ's return have been completed. The Euphrates area has been dried up, and Christ and the saints will soon be entering the land to retake it. Brothers and sisters, during the last 2,000 years, true believers of Christ and the gospel have been subject to brutal persecutions so that their characters might be developed, so that their faith tried, but more importantly, because it was the plan of God. Hopefully, each of us will ponder these events and compare them to Scripture, searching out the matter and thereby growing in faith and zeal. Hopefully, we will never have to endure the pain and torture that some of our brethren have had to endure through the centuries. Let us take their zeal and conviction to invigorate our walk Zionward, let us look at these sprouts of prophecy coming to life and realize that the time is truly short.